Welcome to the podcast where heavy industrial industries meet the venture capital ecosystem, interviewing both thought-leading investors and pioneering founders to better understand the opportunities and challenges that lie ahead for digital industrial innovation. Your host is Ty Finley, and this is the Heavy Hitters Podcast.
Stacy Scapano joins us today from Atlanta, Georgia. He is the National Director of Prefabrication and Manufacturing for J.E. Dunn, a builder ranked as a top 20 national contractor by ENR. Prior to J.E. Dunn, Stacy was a CTO of Skinder and a founding partner for their modular construction company, Skinder Manufacturing. And before that, he was the VP of Innovation at Skanska. And prior to Skanska, Stacy spent 12 years in construction technology as an executive at Tekla, Trimble, and Autodesk, where collectively he played a part in approximately $1 billion of M&A activity across those firms. He has advised numerous startups, including Known Quantity, Mezzo, Construe, and Flexnode, and he currently sits on advisory boards for both the RAND Social and Economic Policy Advisory Board and OCA Ventures. Stacy, great to have you on, my friend. I don't think it was too long ago we were sharing the stage at the Associated Builder and Contractors Convention on the stage talking about construction tech and where it's all headed. So glad we could bring that discussion onto the podcast, and welcome to the Heavy Hitters.
Thank you, Ty. I appreciate it. Twice in 1 month, that's an unusual treat in my world.
I will take it all day. So we always lead in with backgrounds, and I gave a little snippet earlier, but please give us much more of that color commentary behind the scenes of your background that led you into what, you know, I always admirably call construction innovation unicorn status on your side, Stacy.
Yeah, way more humble than construction unicorn and innovation. My beginnings, it was fax machines and styrofoam cups of coffee at a steel fabrication plant in Central Florida. I thought it was really interesting. I mean, a lot of my technology experience that would kind of result throughout the rest of my career was really shaped by some pretty low level thinking, to be perfectly honest with you. I mean, Windows was just coming out, so DOS to Windows. So that was really a proxy for personal computing explosion. So that was just dumb luck and timing. I had horrible handwriting, so I couldn't draw on the board very well. And that was really the measure of a person's prowess, is how well they could letter across a blueprint. And so I got the CAD really early, ultimately traded or trained a lot of our engineers on staff, and just kind of accelerated by accidental personal positioning. As I was going to civil engineering school in the 90s, ultimately went to work at a steel fabrication company, which allowed me to walk shops at lunch. I think that's very key, because I not only got to just hide behind my, you know, swings of the pencil, I got, you know, accosted by a shop foreman on bust in my drawings and thinking. And that turned into a similar dynamic when I worked for one of Tekla's, and we'll get to who Tekla is, structural steel modeling application, like one of their first four customers in the United States at a vertically integrated firm. We weren't using that language. We just had all design disciplines and fabrication and construction in our company in the 90s. And that just kind of gave me an operating environment that allowed me to kind of look at how information flowed, how work got done, and all the frictions that were structurally embedded in the lack of tech, and just kind of the toss it over the fence dynamic that is brought in the broader real estate development and, you know, broader construction ecosystems. So, coming up for air, that was, you know, post.com bubble, 2004. I was really kind of banging on Tekla to, hey, look, you know, fabrication structure is great. We need this in the hands of contractors. There's a lot of opportunity to visualize plans and information. And they just basically kind of tapped out and said, just instead of griping at us, just come and help us. And I was privileged enough to kind of come aboard and do a couple different things. Got a lot of support in the industry for what we were doing. The AGC was spinning up the BIM forum, so I came on as tech chair there. And then just kind of ran strategic partnerships, grew tremendously in bounced over to Trimble and helped the team kind of finalize the acquisition of Tekla, which was a monster in and of itself in about 2011, and then bounced over to Autodesk and ran strategy there while we were spinning up this enormous migration that was kind of twofold, one from an incumbent design technology company in the late 2000s to now focused on the construction vertical, and then also navigating the migration to cloud mobile computing and the like. So that was a lot of the effort, and then ultimately bounced back into the industry kind of 2016.
Love it. Well, we're going to come back to what is clear. You've seen it from all evolutions, as we will talk about over the last decade. A lot has changed in the construction tech ecosystem. But you are the first I've ever heard say bad penmanship is what threw you into software. So,
you should see me write.
I like it. It's about as good a story as we could get. So before we jump into that history per se, I'd also like to set the stage for our listeners. Tell us a little bit more about J.E. Dunn for those who maybe aren't familiar, and what your new role, very hot topic around prefabrication and manufacturing, as you're now the national director of that for J.E. Dunn. Would love to learn a little bit more.
Sure. I mean, first and foremost, I mean, it's been a successful Midwestern family builder just over a 94-year time horizon. It's, of course, grown in scale and not only geographical footprint, but kind of the asset classes and vertical markets that it serves. And, you know, as you said in the lead up in the intro, I mean, it's a top 20 builder. So you've got a number of dynamics at play. I mean, from kind of relationships and reputation of a builder to be able to grow and scale like that, the team and the workforce and the ethics and safety culture. I mean, as a builder, I'm heavily biased, of course, but we're firing on all cylinders. We're in the markets that we need to be. There's great leadership at play. The rank and file is extremely talented and dedicated. And we're very fortunate to serve a lot of the geographies and vertical markets that are growing tremendously, you know, kind of in this COVID, post-COVID era. Personally, my role is really a formalization of what's been happening in industry that J.E. Dunn's been a part of, either vicariously through client demand and demands for prefab and offsite, especially around kind of the early forays in healthcare construction, the innovations with our trade partners as well, a lot of bottom up. I mean, that's a lot of work that's come out of the trades. I was a steel fabricator, as I said. I saw the adoption of BIM early. I saw fabrication and modularity very early in the 90s. I saw vertical integration, design assist very early. A lot of that, I'm very keenly aware that innovation came up through the trades. And as a general contractor, you've got to up your game to make sure that you're enabling, not disabling, that type of innovation. And my role is really to help formalize that body of experience that has happened kind of organically, as well as begin to try to ratchet it up in either the direct investments that J.E. Dunn as a group is leaning into, and or just kind of that growth in the market around moving as much work offsite as possible.
Well, storied GC, and all I had to know is they brought you in to run prefab and manufacturing for what I know now they're committed to. So we're going to come back to that topic as well. Got so many things we're going to cover today, but I do want to let's jump right back in where we left off our tech keynote at the ABC convention that we titled "What's Coming from Construction Tech and What the Heck Do You Do About It?" So much innovation has occurred in just the last decade alone, as we were talking about. Can you give us that historical retrospective you shared with the ABC audience on what is unfolded and those associated structural elements that are really underpinning this last decade of transition?
Yeah, I mean, we'll use the term decade loosely because standing in front of a live crowd, I don't know if it was like this for you, it was definitely for me, but after 2 years of kind of living in a social hole through the pandemic, it was really great to actually see people at a real conference and not a glorified webinar. So I really kind of tried to look at that 2010 through 2020 time period and really put that in perspective, because, you know, I can use the term disruption and people kind of, we get it. We've all seen it. We've had this at the consumer level in our social lives and, you know, somewhat in industry. And it's kind of giving away to a different sentiment. And, you know, I'll just unbury the lead here of uncertainty. And I really wanted to at least report from my personal experience what I had, whatever seat that I had of on the sidelines of seeing through my career. I wanted to give a framework. And going into, let's just say that 2010, the beginning of the decade, I think it's really key to understand our role as an industry, let's just loosely say construction, real estate, what shock it was genuinely going through. And specifically, if you look at housing, housing is on the order of 2 to 3x the size of non-residential construction. So this is really significant. If you just kind of discount it, because most of our big builders, you like to think of us for skyscrapers or our sporting arena, the sources of construction and labor and employment, materials, they don't care. And when you have such a shock to something that's 2 to 3x bigger than everything else, it will factor in. So that's a really long-winded way to say the period from 2005 to 2010 saw a 75% decline in housing starts. I think around 2005, you're looking at 2 million housing units per year coming online, and it dropped down to 500,000 units post-financial crisis 2010, and just bumped along the bottom. And, you know, think of it what you will, but you can hear this huge whooshing sound out of the market for capacity. If you're not funding those jobs and those materials aren't getting absorbed, you're basically taking out an enormous input to the capacity of construction. Obviously, specific to the residential markets, but those carpenters, you know, those electricians, all of the trades, the logistics, begin finding new homes in places like distribution centers and warehouses, moving products as other buying behaviors and other demand comes online. So that is super key. And if you look at that as a backdrop to, it takes you from 2012 to present day to begin seeing this massive contraction begin to try to norm itself up with, on average, just over 2% employment growth in U.S. construction that we see today, which is better than negative, but it is paltry in comparison to the 6% growth that we're in the middle of forecasting in the industry at large until 2025. That's 2% industry growth, digging ourselves out of a hole into a relative boom. And that's on average, that 6% industry growth. In certain markets, as I said, here at J.E. Dunn, we get to service a lot of really hyper growth markets, vertical markets. Take data centers alone, they're on the order of 13 to 14%. There's this massive scale, massive capital programs between chip manufacturing that you can read in the headlines of Wall Street Journal and the movement there, infrastructure spending that makes headlines, of course. Here again, you have this enormous capacity slosh and demand shock in different parts of our market. Meanwhile, this kind of bubbling employment growth coming out of that decade-long hole. And, you know, I would be horribly remiss and putting up a huge blind spot if I didn't acknowledge where we're at, you know, knock on wood, post-COVID, you know, barring future variants and, you know, geopolitical risk and what that's done to our supply chain. Now, everyone's going to talk about inflation, and we saw it in double digits. We continue to see it sub high single, low double digit inflation forecast throughout the year. But that's only half the story, because when you talk about the supply chains and the inputs, you talk about availability, and those availabilities immediately turn into, does the pricing make my deal pencil and the project go away? or does the timing push it so far back that the entire investment pro forma is out of whack? So this is why I said, you know, we can talk about tech and you could talk about what spun up this disruption monitor at the early part of the decade, go fast and break things, which had a nice pop in a season. But I mean, to take a broader zoom lens and take a huge step back where we are, there's a lot of uncertainty that we're all operating in, and it's exacerbated by capacity constraints with labor.
Gotcha. So when we have this whooshing sound of capacity constraint, labor shortages, and ultimately supply chain issues, maybe now bend in that macro outlook with, you know, I think you and I were even talking, you saw the first, call it quote unquote construction app, what, circa 2011? Mm-hmm. But I'd love to fold in that tech side of how you've seen that ramp up, maybe to come in and help with some of these inefficiencies or just call it structural things that aren't going to get fixed without a little bit of a digital innovation journey ahead of it.
Yeah, I mean, even kind of a preamble to that, as I hear you ask the question, I mean, if you go all the way back, you know, pre-2000s, you know, somewhere in the square 90s, look at what I was talking about. I mean, personal computing. I mean, just the fact that I was literally scared of my own handwriting by pencil. We were waiting by fax machines to listen for answers to questions and, you know, worse than snail mail-like experience in our industry. And that's how we were building complicated structures. That's proper scar tissue. And the reason why I bring that up is you have, you know, blessed with the internet, dissemination of information, 2000, we start moving from digitizing spreadsheets in the 90s to now task-specific applications up to 2010. The reason why you see this enormous grind through the gearbox in the last decade is because, you know, iPhone 2008, iPad summer of 2010, it took a while for the development community to start industry by industry recognizing there's a thing called an app store. So in construction, we got the first apps on the iPad. And as you alluded to, our team at Autodesk was on an acquisition hunt in the early 2011 because, you know, existing programmers, developers didn't build in the cloud. They didn't build mobile first. They didn't exist. And that was one decade ago. And that's what I was trying to really express and communicate to the crowd last month. And so what that meant is you needed to not only acquire capability, you need to acquire your own development capacity, an acqui-hire, so to speak, at that when you had fundamental computing shifts. You know, what's your cloud strategy was a advertising slogan in the early 2010s that nobody really properly understood, and we had to get our hands around it. So as you alluded to, winding down 2011, going into 2012, we closed an acquisition, a couple of acquisitions, a cloud-based modeling solution, model visualization solution, and the one of two apps on the iPad for construction in 2011. Built out the genesis of the BIM 360 and the construction cloud that Autodesk is bringing to market today. And, you know, in hindsight, again, it's just, it's obvious. Anytime, anywhere, any device, the whole world operates this way. You probably do this on, you know, five different aspects of, you know, your personal banking, to your documents, to your pictures, to your email. Yeah, no kidding. But 10 years ago, I was told to just leave the office as I was trying to explain to executive teams across the planet of what we were doing and how, you know, moving information to the cloud and ultimately mobile devices were connecting the digital plans that we had built for 20 years in construction now to the real-time performance that was happening on site, getting us from firefighting to proactive, instead of responsive, but proactive management of real-time feedback loops for construction, planning work better. And like I said, early organizations, great partners worked with us really well. There was a lot of friction. It didn't take but 4 years to see explosive growth because of the no-brainer of connecting the workforce through technology. To pair that acceleration, as I think I shared with you and in the group at in San Antonio last month, it's 2016 where Built Worlds as a trade association comes in with their model of a tech forward group, not a broader, you know, incumbent association or industry group that has technology tracks in their effort, but they're tech forward and have evolved to, by the time 2016 comes around, to hosting a executive technology forum specifically for CEOs in 2016. And so to me, that was the seminal moment, not only of the tech that we were presenting in 2016, you know, all the flavors in play, but also the fact that it wasn't propeller heads driving technology. It was a broader signal from the market that there was a realization that technology and innovation is becoming core to business strategy in our industry. And all those flavors of technology were at play. We were unpacking the early ingredients of analytics and automation and IoT and AR, VR, and drones, and what does that mean, and where does that project forward? And then that's where, personally, I came to the realization I could probably bounce back into industry and help organizations rationalize this wave that's coming.
Yeah, and you got to give a shout out to your point. Built Worlds, Matt Gray, amazing job catalyzing a lot of this discussion. And I'll use this as a segue into, you know, it even fits your background as an advisor to OCA Ventures. Let's talk about, you know, one of the themes on this podcast is when venture capital is colliding with these legacy industries, and obviously only one of many vectors that we're throwing fuel on this digital transformation fire for the construction industry. But it is a key part of this storyline with the risk capital that's come to bear. And around this role that tech investment and venture capital has played to only accelerate all the structural change that you mentioned. So maybe just a couple interesting stats for the audience that came from a McKinsey analysis about construction tech's proliferation. They outlined that both from 2014 to 2019, investors poured $25 billion into engineering and construction technology, which was up from $8 billion over the prior 5 years before that. And that on a comparative basis, so you got to use relative size here, but VC investment in construction tech specifically outpaced the overall VC industry 15-fold through 2019. And I don't have the latest numbers to quantify this, but I can assure you it didn't slow down from 2020 to 2021. So all that buildup, a few questions here, but they're all tied together. But when do you think this capital started to race in, Stacy? Why are we starting to see more contech innovators attract the deals in dollars that we talked about down in San Antonio? And do you think this flywheel effect is underway now that it's only snowballing, or where do you think it goes from here?
Yeah. So help me remember the three questions as I ramble.
Sure.
But I believe the first one was when. Mm-hmm. And so I think you see kind of the bend in the curve right about where we left off with kind of that 2016 moment of execs having a proper forum, you know, Matt Gray's leadership there with Built Worlds, and then kind of the subsequent ripples of, you know, getting from just generalized propeller heads driving the conversation to what does it mean to kind of innovate as an organization? There's other kind of weaker signals. Like, look at the changes in job titles in over the last decade. You brought in like VDC directors again. So you're beginning to see kind of a, I don't want to use the term aging, but this maturing of the industry and even some of the individuals that it drove a lot of that tech, like now have teams of people. This becomes a bigger and bigger force in the middle of the last decade. You can also see it in those numbers. In 2018, JLL did a report. There was $1 billion of deal flow, just venture, not private equity, not M&A, $1 billion in half the year. So you just see this hockey stick acceleration of VC dollar, 2016 to present. And as you said, it's just not slowing down. There was a little bit of a why 1B question, I think, in there of what were we also highlighting that I think venture specifically teed off on? As I said, you saw the ingredients, and those ingredients are pretty agnostic. It's, you know, healthcare, finance, you know, manufacturing. We're all trying to figure out, what does analytics mean? What do sensors and the Internet of Things mean? What does automation mean? You know, different levels of maturity, different baselines, but we all have kind of the same ingredients in the kitchen as far as tech goes. The big difference that I think VC coalesced around on our industry is that the stat that we use, and I apologize to Forrester and Gartner, I have no idea who did this chart, but we were like a click above hunting, I think, as far as tech spend by revenue as an industry out of like 30 industries. 1% of revenues is what we would spend. And I think that was not only an indictment that put, you know, speaking of hunting, a huge bullseye on our industry of like, there's a lot of uplift here. There's a lot of spend potential if the offering, the supply side got itself sorted to where we can consume it as an industry. And as I said, I think you just saw this coalescing around it. I think question two was why? And so I think that, you know, the one B to two, I think the other dynamic that gets overlooked a lot, but is probably obvious when I say it, is that I think the generational zeitgeist of entrepreneurialism is something that if you're older than 40, you're going to really struggle to understand. Me and all of my cohorts, I'm assuming at least 30 years of college graduates before me, we all sought out the biggest brand to put on our resumes as quickly as possible after getting that diploma. Nowadays, and probably for the better part of the last decade, if you're really shoulder to shoulder with some of these college graduates, or, you know, while they're going through their academic career, they are tracking towards an understanding that now's the time to take on risk. Now's the time, unlike in the 90s, you know, access to capital is, you know, this part of this conversation, but the need for capital, because you could spin up an instance on Amazon for free. You can rent every bit of software. You know, there, the hurdle rate is so low. So the risk is relatively low. And the, like I said, the cultural zeitgeist is like, why would you go work for a lumbering big brand like we chased in previous generations? You have this confluence of a supply side and demand side for venture to find a place. Third, the flywheel effect. And scale begets scale. And I think the incumbents have really kind of taken the Clayton Christensen 30-year mantra of innovation needs to technically happen outside the company. I think the success of M&A deals that are accretive to growth. And you see a lot of exit trajectories that can happen. Private equity taking more and taking different knock-on stages so that there's a reward there. And I think that's kind of a dynamic that's not really well seen if you're day-to-day with the broad set of my peers, you know, are focused on, you know, keeping a project on its rails, on budget and on time, and, you know, making sure that the customer keeps satisfied and, you know, no one's getting hurt. You know, this stuff is just kind of in the ether happening around you, and it's just not something that's on your radar that much.
Yeah, well, I think you nailed all three, and it's a part of this too to me is, you know, back to the Built World guys, I give them another shout out. They did an exit report from last year, and I think the chart showed 9 Built Worlds unicorn exits. So I think the trending years before that, maybe 1 or 2 a year, something like that. So the liquidity that's being poured back into the capital and the private markets, it's recycling capital, obviously, but it's also recycling a whole bunch of talent as well. And I'm not kidding you, I was Googling as we went, J.E. Dunn, McCarthy, DPR, looking for those titles you mentioned that were transitioning into head of this software, that or the other. So it's amazing to see the change that's coming, and I'll probably try to find a stat on all of the titles that are finding their way into the big co. So Well, maybe I'll push this forward here, Stacy, with the last question. And it really comes back to what you're doing at J.E. Dunn. And it is truly a hot, hot topic around prefab and modular. So our audience loves hearing about latest trends and areas that have, you know, fast moving adoption within this broader emerging world of digital industrial, as we call it. And you're certainly living at the tip of the spear when it comes to that topic of prefab and modular. So aligned, and I don't know who I heard it from first, but this term constructuring is now synonymous with construction becoming more and more associated with lean manufacturing production processes before product has ever hit a construction job site. So maybe just tell us, how do you define prefab and modular construction, and what's your take regarding the significance it will have in the years to come?
Yeah, I think there's just like anything of significance, there's a broad spectrum, which also can mean it can be distorted to polls and misunderstood, and a speaker on one end of the spectrum talking to a listener on the other end of the spectrum. And for me to define that spectrum, I try to think of prefab and modularity kind of in two dimensions to keep it simple. In one dimension, you have what discipline. Is it a single discipline? Like me and steel and fabrication in the 90s, we were doing prefab. I mean, you don't want to drill through a 1-inch plate on site and have 20,000 bolts to install. That's a miserable exercise. So you want to prefabricate. And then as you do that, you realize that one stick can become, you know, a frame truss, and that frame truss can be a panel, or it could be a module and an array. And so you have these dimensions of, am I a single discipline, electrical, mechanical, plumbing, structural, exterior? Am I multiple disciplines creating a new component or assembly? So that's kind of one dimension to the spectrum, one axis. The other would be kind of just like a physical geometry bit. And at the lowest level, are you pre-processing something? Are you kitting something? I love the fact that some of our trades will go room by room. I have a really great electrical trade partner here in Atlanta that just sat me down at their table and showed how all of the electrical accessories in a room for this hospital, switches and outlets and, you know, all of these pieces, you know, took up two tables worth, workbenches worth, like 10, 15 foot long workbenches of boxes and packaging. And they were able to pre-process them, make clips and ties and everything, unbox everything, and put it down to what would look like one of the Scapano family's nightly Amazon delivery boxes, and code it and tag it, and everything's pre-processed. So the whole notion of just kitting gets you to that constructuring lean. That's definitely a lean principle, pre-process, get the waste out of the system. Somebody shipping boxing material to fill up a dumpster, to have a high-paid, high-skilled technician navigate box upon box, which just makes no sense. And then if you move up the kind of quote-unquote geometry spectrum, you know, can I get sticks of raw goods into a panel? Can I get those panels into a volume? You know, what level of finish are we at? Are you gonna put the final drywall line on site? Are you gonna ship it with drywall? If so, does it have windows, or do you install the windows? So those, that level of finish adds kind of maybe a third dimension to how I see the prefab and modularization space.
Got it. And you know, I'll slide one more in here just because we do have a lot of startups listening. J.E. Dunn, 94-year-old, top 20 builder, lots of resources to verticalize and exactly, you know, the strategy that you're running. How do you give some kind of quick hitter, what's worked, what doesn't work, when you really are advising or talking with some of these early stage startups that are looking to try to advance the prefab and modular ecosystem?
Yeah, I mean, taking a huge step back and kind of blurring my present day with a little bit of the past and what we got to see with all that activity in the last decade. I mean, even blurring kind of the mentality around lean, and that has also blurred into lean startups and, you know, the guidance that a lot of entrepreneurs are following right now. It can't be stressed enough. Anchoring the center bit of every internal and external conversation around value. And the reason why I gave you that ramble around the setup of lean is because if you take the lean understanding of value, it's not what you and I say is valuable from this conversation. It is the listener. It is the audience. It is your customer. And what I love about that is it forces you to get out of sight of your head, because everything that you and I are going to say, people are going to love this conversation, whatever it might be, is probably a first order interpretation of anything we might say. But if you're looking at it from a listener perspective, you know, is it an investor? Is it a founder? It's the second order impact. What are they going to do differently because of that, whatever it is that you delivered? And those second order impacts defined by a customer probably are more at the heart of a value conversation of what you're offering. And I cannot stress this enough, because what tends to happen, especially early days, products are immature. So you want to kind of tortoiseshell back into the excuse of, I need to refine the product more, I need to focus on this. But really, that's a lot of effort and resources being consumed on the hypothesis of what the founders or your head of product or whoever might be driving out to the market. Getting butts in seats with customers to consume whatever it is that you're pitching or selling, you begin to get that, what happens if we did scale? What happens if we scaled at this customer? What would they do different? Why are they delighted? And that allows you to kind of pull your time. How do you spend and prioritize development? How do you frame that up in resources? How do you model that into the growth of the company? Who would be my target customer if that's the real value proposition? 9 times out of 10. The whole term pivot came from that mentality. And I think people gloss over the necessary muscle that it takes to understand the work that it takes to do that deliberately.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. A lot of talk about technologies and things of that nature, but it just comes down to the customer and what value you're driving for them. So I couldn't agree with it. And I know we could spend a long time talking about prefab and modular, but I will wrap us up here. We have a section called Quick Hitters. So it's a little bit of a rapid fire Q&A, Stacy. So if you're ready, we'll jump in there.
Let's do it.
All right. Number one thing you're looking for when you are looking at one of these earlier stage founders who's building within this ecosystem.
Are you a tourist?
Tell us more.
This is the dark side of that kind of zeitgeist in this upcoming generation, is that I think a lot of the founders that are coming out are doing it because they want a CEO title as their first blip on a resume. They want to be a founder for the sake of being a founder, and they're not really resonating with the industry that they're serving. They may be geeking out a little bit on the technologies that they're advancing, but they're talking the words, but really, again, they're not putting themselves in industry, trying to understand the opportunities or challenges that they're really trying to smooth out or scale for their respective audiences. And, you know, that's just an old skate punk, and unfortunately I'm dating myself and probably coloring myself, but you know, we call them posers in the 80s. There's just a lot of that. And a lot of times, you know, they think they're talking a good game, but they're also putting up horrible red flags. And you just got to make sure the motives are there.
There you go. Well, one resource could be book, podcast, blog, whatever you'd recommend our audience to follow in the ecosystem.
So I'm going to strike on one and then hopefully make contact as a quick hitter on the second. So I'm going to give you two. One, because as I heard myself talk about putting value at the center of every conversation, there's a book called Business Model Generation by Osterwalder. And I'm sorry if this has already been recommended. This should be, if it isn't, you know, on the desk of every founder, entrepreneur. And to me, at the heart of it is the business model canvas. And at the heart of the business model canvas is the value proposition. And it's just a simple framework, literally a way to chart out your 10-page, 20-page business plan, but it's on one sheet of paper that you can constantly stress test. And I've done this as a founder. I've done this when I've evaluated strategic partnerships at large companies. I do that when I'm listening to companies that are meeting an investment. If I can't sketch out their business plan in front of me with a value proposition that is jumping off the page, front and center, how you make money to the right and how you spend money to the left and what bottoms out, is it, that framework, that canvas should become muscle memory. And I think it's a great way to, in the velocity of, you know, common everyday life or, you know, corporate America in 2022, this is a tool that it's the closest thing I've found in my career to a Swiss Army knife, and it's applicable in multiple settings. On the flip side, that's, you know, if you're looking for a pragmatic tool, on the flip side, I would be remiss if, you know, if you're a little bit more seasoned in your career, I think there's a heroic effort going on by Ray Dalio right now in his principles effort. He released the book. And if you don't know him, Ray Dalio, founder of Bridgewater, probably the largest hedge fund. Speaking of the last decade, you know, made the right call to short the housing market. You know, made a ton of mistakes before that and writes about them. He's in, you know, the later stages of his career, growing Bridgewater, and his principles book, the first of a trilogy, is just an opus into something that I'm going to horribly dumb down of how do you know you're right and making sure that you hold yourself accountable to your decision-making process. How did you come to that decision? Can you account for the knowns that pointed you in that direction? How did you account for the unknowns? I think it's fantastic guidance, and let alone anything else that he's done around the broader, you know, he's got economic videos. He's got, you know, The Changing World Order, which is a second book, horribly dense. I'm halfway through it right now. Wonderfully timed because of the geopolitic dynamic that's going on. And then there's another book that's due out in the next couple of years around his investing principles. But my gosh, anything the guy says, I'm not 100% aligned with his bearishness of the market moving forward, but I totally appreciate his willingness at this stage of his life to open source how he did it. And it's a high recommend if you're looking for something beyond a glorified HBR podcast.
Both of them incredibly impactful. So good suggestions. Stacey, one person who should be on the podcast.
If you get them, Ray Dalio.
There you go. I like it. Good segue. Okay. And then finally, best way for folks to reach out to you, Stacey.
LinkedIn. I'm admittedly slow, but I mean, that's easy. And I do check it. I eventually get through it. Give me a week or so. I mean, that's about my rhythm, but that's a no-brainer. And, for you, Ty, we'll do something similar that we did to the ABC. We'll try to create a link maybe in your show notes to all the stats and the reports. I mean, I try to be very deliberate about sourcing all of our materials so we weren't just grabbing numbers out of thin air. And maybe we could do that for this podcast as well.
Make sure we do it. And just a big appreciation, Stacey, all the things you've seen and the lessons learned and sharing them for the audience today. I know this will be a fun one for the audience to get a hold of. So appreciate you making some time, Stacey.
Anytime, Ty. Appreciate what you're doing as well.